Human Nature. Peter Richardson, Distinguished Professor Emeritus, Department of Environmental Science and Policy, University of California, Davis. Author, Not by Genes Alone. The concept of human nature has considerable currency among evolutionists who are interested in humans. Yet, when examined closely, it's vacuous. Worse, it confuses the thought processes of those who attempt to use it. Useful concepts are those that cut nature at its joints. Human nature smashes bones. Human nature implies that our species is characterized by a common core of features that define us. Evolutionary biology teaches us that this sort of essentialist concept of species is wrong. A species is an assemblage of variable individuals, albeit individuals sufficiently genetically similar that they can successfully interbreed. Most species share most of their genes with ancestral and related species, as we do with other apes. In most species, ample genetic variation ensures that no two individuals are genetically identical. Many species contain geographically structured genetic variation, as modern humans do. A few tens of thousands of years ago, our genus seems to have comprised a couple of African species and three Eurasian ones, all of which interbred enough to leave traces in living genomes. Most species, and the populations of which they're composed, are relentlessly evolving. The human populations that have adopted agriculture in the Holocene have undergone a wave of genetic changes to adapt to a diet rich in starchy staples and other agricultural products, and an environment rich in epidemic pathogens taking advantage of dense, settled human populations. Some human populations today are subject to new selective pressures, owing to diseases of abundance. The evolution of resistance to such diseases is detectable. Some geneticists argue that genes affecting our behavior have come under recent selection to adapt to life in complex societies. The concept of human nature causes people to look for explanations under the wrong rock. Take the most famous human nature argument: are people by nature good or evil? In recent years, experimentalists have conducted tragedy of the commons games and observed how people solve the tragedy, if they do. A typical finding is that roughly a third of the participants act as selfless leaders, using whatever tools the experimenters make available to solve the dilemma of cooperation. Roughly a tenth are selfish exploiters of any cooperation that arises, and the balance are guarded cooperators with flexible morals. This result comports with everyone's personal experience. Some people are routinely honest and generous, a few are downright psychopathic, and many people fall somewhere in between. Human society would be entirely different if this weren't so. The human nature debate on the topic is sterile because it ignores something we all know if we stop to think about it. Darwin's great contribution to biology was to abandon essentialism and focus on variation and its transmission. He made remarkable progress, even though organic inheritance was a black box in his day. He also got the main problem of human variability right. In The Descent of Man, he argued that humans were biologically a rather ordinary species with a rather ordinary amount of geographical variation. Yet, in many ways, the amount of human behavioral variation is far outside the range of that of other species. The Fuegans, who adapted to a hunter-gatherer life on the Strait of Magellan, were sharply different from a leisured gentleman naturalist from Shrewsbury, but these differences owe mainly to different customs and traditions, not organic differences. Darwin also realized that the evolution of traditions responded to selective processes other than natural selection. Traditions are shaped by human choices, a little like the artificial selection of domesticates, with natural selection playing a subordinate role. In his biographical sketch of an infant, Darwin described how readily children learn from their caregivers. The inheritance of traditions, customs, and language is relatively easy to observe with the tools of a 19th-century naturalist, compared to the intricacies of genetic inheritance, which is still yielding fundamental secrets to the high-tech tools of molecular biology. Recent work on the mechanisms underlying imitation and teaching has begun to reveal the more deeply hidden cognitive components of these processes, and the results underpin Darwin's phenomenological account of tradition acquisition and evolution. In no field is the deficiency of the human nature concept better illustrated than in its use in trying to understand learning, culture, and cultural evolution. Human nature thinking leads to the conclusion that causes of behavior can be divided into nature and nurture. Nature is conceived of as causally prior to nurture, both in evolutionary and developmental time. What evolves is nature, and cultural variation, whatever it is, has to be the causal handmaiden of nature. This is simply counterfactual. If the dim window that stone tools give us doesn't lie, culture and cultural variation have been fundamental adaptations of our lineage, perhaps going back to late Australopiths. The elaboration of technology over the last 2 million years has roughly paralleled the evolution of larger brains and other anatomical changes. We have clear examples of cultural changes driving genetic evolution, such as the evolution of dairying driving the evolution of adult lactase persistence. Socially learned technology could have been doing similar things all throughout the last 2 million years. The human capacity for social learning develops so early in the first year of life that developmentalists have had to design very clever experiments to probe what infants are learning months before language and precise imitative behavior exist. At least from 12 months onward, social learning begins to transmit the discoveries of cultures to children with every opportunity for these discoveries to interact with gene expression. In autistic children, this social learning mechanism is more or less severely compromised, leading to more or less severely developmentally disabled adults. Human culture is best conceived of as a part of human biology, like our bipedal locomotion. It's a source of variation we've used to adapt to most of the world's terrestrial and amphibious habitats. The human nature concept, like essentialism more generally, makes it impossible to think straight about human evolution.
The Urvogel, Julia Clark, Associate Professor, John A. Wilson Centennial Fellow in Vertebrate Paleontology, Jackson School of Geosciences, University of Texas, Austin. I would like to put to rest the notion that evolution as a process should conform to words and concepts we find familiar, comfortable, and perhaps even universal. More immediately, I'd like to stop having always to explain whether or not each new feathered dinosaur specimen we discover was a bird. In many ways, it's an understandable question. Most scientists have accepted for years that living birds are one lineage of dinosaurs. The idea that dinosaurs live on in birds has even crept into popular consciousness via Jurassic Park. So perhaps it's not surprising that when scientists discover a new feathered dinosaur, people, including scientists and science journalists, often want to know, did it fly? Consider the so-called Urvogel, the first discovered feathered dinosaur, Archaeopteryx. Debate continues in the scientific literature. Was it a bird? As a paleontologist working on the evolution of living birds, I find myself having this exchange over and over again. For example, I describe a small feathery species newly uncovered from fossil record. After detailing its known features, I might note that it may have had some form of aerial locomotion. There is inevitably a pause. Then comes the question. Okay, but was it a bird? Impatient with scientists and their endless modifiers and complex phrasing, the asker wants to get this story clear. Okay, but did it fly? Tell it to me straight. The questions may sound innocent enough, and perhaps are natural to ask. However, Although they seem like scientific questions, they mostly aren't. They concern primarily what we want to identify as part of a class of entities, birds, and what part of that class, flighted. We might think we have these distinctions straight today, but try looking back through a dirty lens at life more than 100 million years ago. Paleontologists use the shape and form of bones, as well as, in rare cases, feathery impressions, to track the ecologies of the long dead. To do this, they use data on form, function, relationships in the living. This task is itself difficult and ongoing. But what's more difficult is to translate combinations of structures not present in any living species into an understanding of how the animal under study moved. For example, flighted living birds have a joint between the scapula and coracoid where the upper arm bone, humerus, meets the pectoral girdle. Yet we have species in the fossil record with feathered forelimbs of impressive span, shall we call them wings, but lacking this kind of joint articulation. Subtle features of the feathers and their relative proportions may differ from any living bird. Is this creature a bird? How did it move? Did it have a kind of sustained flapping flight, but unlike that in any extant species? If we could time travel back to a Cretaceous forest, would we call this movement flight? What if a species beat its wings only briefly to move from branch to branch? What if it utilized these wing beats to climb trees or jump? What if it was only volant as a juvenile, while as a large-bodied adult, it maintained feathery forelimbs for signaling to a mate, but flew no longer? All these hypotheses have been put forward, and all may have been true for different denizens of Jurassic and Cretaceous environments. We can debate whether these creatures flew, and whether or not they were birds by contemporary definition, but in doing so, we risk losing sight of the bigger scientific questions. All too quickly, we can fall into a rabbit hole of defining and defending terms when we do better to seek a more precise understanding of the emergence, the relative evolutionary first appearances, of the many features comprising the flight apparatus in living birds. Feathers make their first appearance in taxa that could not have been volant as adults. Precursors to feathers, simple filaments, are found in tyrannosaurids and an array of other relatives of living birds. While hundreds of characteristics of bone and feather have revealed these deep genealogical relationships within dinosaurs, we still seem to be searching to pin bird and flight to single characters. I'm not the first to remark that the debate over what to call a bird and what to term flight is not useful and is actually at odds with evolutionary thinking. But I'm surprised by the persistence of this debate even among specialists. For example, exchanges over how to apply the formal taxonomic name, Aves, are ongoing. While events unfolding in deep time via evolutionary processes are arguably the least likely candidates for dichotomous or categorical thinking, this mode of thought runs rampant and engenders false controversies that obscure interesting questions. Tracking the more complex pattern of asynchronous change in many novel traits is what will inform generalities about how the evolution of shape and form may work. The hypotheses we investigate should be arrayed relative to one another in relationships rather than opposition. However, often the categories we're comfortable with will artificially organize them into this apparent relationship. Indeed, across science, we have many Urvogels, lingering evidence of similarly strong collective cognitive investment in the existence of classes of entities we consider intuitive and natural. These can hold us back.
Numbering Nature. Kurt Gray, Assistant Professor of Social Psychology, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I was much struck how entirely vague and arbitrary is the distinction between species and varieties. Darwin, On the Origin of Species, 1859. For centuries, there was one way to bring order to the vastness of biological diversity, Linnaean classification. In the 18th century, Carl Linnaeus devised a method for dividing species based on their description. Do they look the same? Do they behave the same? With Linnaean classification, you could divide the natural world into discrete kinds. You could count them, saying confidently, there are two species of elephants, or there are four kinds of bears. Some psychologists seek to bring the same order to the mind, claiming that there are six emotions, there are five types of personality, or there are three moral concerns. These psychologists are inspired by the precision, order, and neatness of Linnaeus's ideas. The only problem is that Linnaeus was wrong. Linnaeus lived about 100 years before Darwin introduced his theory of evolution by natural selection, and he long believed that species were fixed and unchangeable. His religious roots led him to see species as a product of divine providence, and his job was simply to catalog these distinct kinds, taking as his motto, God created, Linnaeus organized. If God created a certain number of distinct species, cataloging and counting them made sense. It was meaningful to ask, how many kinds of salamanders did God create? Evolution, however, destroyed the sanctity of species. Species were not created whole from the beginning, but instead emerged over time through the repetition of a simple algorithm, heredity, mutation, and selection. Evolution showed that a dizzying diversity of life, from viruses to cacti to humans, were explained through a basic set of common processes expressed in different environments. This common process means that lines between species are more in the minds of humans than in nature, with many intermediate animals, lungfish, for example, and hybrids, ligers, for example, that defy easy categorization. Moreover, in geological time, these divisions are even more arbitrary, with species diverging and converging as continents separate and collide. Biology has realized that species are not reflections of eternal divine order, but simply a useful way to intuitively organize the world. Unfortunately, psychology lags behind. Many psychologists believe that the mental world is fixed and countable, that the appearance of mental states reflects a deeper essence. Introductory psychology textbooks contain numbered lists of psychological species, five kinds of human needs, six basic emotions, three moral concerns, three kinds of love, three parts of the mind, with these lists depending primarily upon the intuitions of whoever is doing the counting. Like those of Linnaeus in the 18th century, these intuitive taxonomies were once the best we could do because psychology lacked an understanding of basic psychological processes. However, social cognition and neuroscience has revealed these processes and found that diverse mental experiences, emotion, morality, motivation, are combinations of more basic affective and cognitive processes. This research suggests that psychological states are not firmly demarcated things with enduring essences, but are instead fuzzy constructs emerging from common psychological processes expressed across different environments. Just as evolution can create a multitude of species by expressing a common process in specific environments, so too can the mind create a multitude of mental species. You can no more count emotions or moral concerns than snowflakes or colors. To be sure, there are descriptive similarities and differences across instances, but groupings are arbitrary and rest heavily on the intuition of researchers. This is why scientists can never agree on the fundamental number of anything. One scientist may divide a mental experience into three, another into four, and another into five. It's time for psychology to abandon the enterprise of numbering nature and recognize that psychological species are neither distinct nor real. Biology has long recognized the arbitrary and constructed nature of species. Why are we more than 200 years behind? The likely answer is that people, even including psychologists and philosophers, believe that intuitions, as products of the mind, are accurate reflections of its structure. Unfortunately, decades of research demonstrate the flaws of intuitive realism, revealing that intuitions about the mind are poor guides to underlying psychological processes. Psychologists must move from counting to combining. Counting is simply describing the world, one psychologist's intuitive ordering of mental states in one culture at one time. Combining seeks to find basic psychological elements and discover how they interact to create the mental world. In biology, counting asks, how many kinds of salamanders are there? Whereas combining asks, what processes lead to salamander diversity? Counting is bound to a specific environment and time, whereas combining recognizes these factors as processes themselves. Psychology must follow biology and move from numbering individual species to exploring underlying systems. This process has already begun. Thomas Insull, the head of the National Institute of Mental Health, has prioritized systems over species in psychopathology research. He rejects the utility of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, suggesting that intuitive taxonomies obscure underlying processes of psychopathology and impede the discovery of treatments. NIMH funds proposals that examine the underlying affective, conceptual, and neurological systems, which may explain why the distinct disorders of depression and anxiety are so often comorbid, and why selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, appear to help diverse disorders. Psychopathology doesn't easily fit into categories, and neither do other psychological phenomena. Of course, we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. It's still necessary to catalog the natural world to allow meaningful discussion. Even in biology, where the power of the process of evolution is undisputed, most acknowledge the utility of Linnaeus's system and continue to use the names he provided centuries ago. But the key is not to confuse human constructions with natural order. What's useful to humans isn't necessarily true of nature. Intuitive taxonomies are a necessary first step in psychological science, but even Linnaeus, as he learned more about the world, recognized the arbitrariness of his system and the species he labeled. It's time for psychology to recognize this fact as well, and leave Linnaeus and the 18th century behind. Hardwired equals permanent. Michael Shermer, founding publisher, Skeptic Magazine, monthly columnist, Scientific American, author, The Believing Brain. The scientific idea that a trait or characteristic of an organism that's hardwired means it's a permanent feature should be retired. Case in point, God and religion. Ever since Charles Darwin theorized in his 1871 book, The Descent of Man, that a belief in all-pervading spiritual agencies seems to be universal, and therefore an evolved characteristic of our species hardwired into our brains, scientists have been running experiments and conducting surveys to show why God won't go away. Anthropologists have found such human universals as specific supernatural beliefs about death and the afterlife, fortune and misfortune, and especially magic, myths, rituals, divination, and folklore. Behavioral geneticists report from twin studies, most notably of twins separated at birth and raised in different environments, that between 40% and 50% of the variants of God beliefs and religiosity are genetic. Some scientists have even claimed to have found a God gene, or more precisely, a God gene complex, that leads humans to have a need for spiritual transcendence and belief in a higher power of some kind. Even specific elements of religious stories, such as a destructive flood, a virgin birth, miracles, a resurrection from the dead, seem to appear independently over and over again throughout history in a wide variety of cultures, implying that there's a hardwired component to religion and God beliefs. I have held this theory myself. Until now. If and when we establish a permanent colony on Mars, if its members consist of non-believing scientists with a purely secular worldview, it would be interesting to check in 10 or 100 generations to see whether God has returned. Until that experiment is conducted, however, we have to consider the results of natural experiments run here on Earth. In the Western world, for example, a 2013 survey of 14,000 people in 13 nations, Germany, France, Sweden, Spain, Switzerland, Turkey, Israel, Canada, Brazil, India, South Korea, and the UK and US, conducted by the German pollster Bertelsmann Stiftung for their Religion Monitor, found that most of those countries showed a declining trend in religiosity and belief in God, especially among the youth. In Spain, for example, 85% of respondents over the age of 45 report being moderately to very religious, but only 58% of those under 29 so report. In Europe in general, only 30 to 50% say that religion is important in their lives, and in many European countries, less than a third say they believe in God. Even in the uber-religious United States, the pollsters found that 31% of Americans say they're not religious or not very religious. This finding confirms those of a 2012 Pew Forum survey, that the fastest-growing religious cohort in the U.S. are the nuns, those with no religious affiliation, at 20%, 33% of adults under 30, broken down into atheists and agnostics at 6% and the unaffiliated at 14%. The raw numbers are stunning. With the U.S. adult population, age 18 and over, at 240 million, this translates into 48 million nuns, or 14.4 million atheists agnostics, and 33.6 million unaffiliated. There were also generational differences revealing a significant trend toward unbelief, with the greatest generation, born 1913 through 1927, at 5%, the silent generation, born 1928 through 1945, at 9%, the boomers, born 1946 through 1964, at 15%, the Gen Xers, born 1965 through 1980, at 21%, the older millennials, born 1981 through 1989, at 30%, and the younger millennials, born 1990 through 1994, at 34%. At this rate, I project that the nuns will reach 100% in the year 2220. It's time for scientists to retire the theory that God and religion are hardwired into our brains. Like everyone else, scientists are subject to cognitive biases that tilt their thinking toward trying to explain common beliefs. So it's good for us to take the long view and compare today with, say, half a millennium ago, when God beliefs were virtually 100%, or with the hunter-gatherer tribes of our Paleolithic ancestors who, while employing any number of superstitious rituals, didn't believe in a god or practice a religion that even remotely resembles the deities or religions of modern peoples. This indicates that religious faith and belief in God is a byproduct of other cognitive processes, for example, agency detection, and cultural propensities, the need to affiliate, that, while hardwired, can be expunged through reason and science, in the same manner as any number of other superstitious rituals and supernatural beliefs once held by the most learned scholars and scientists of Europe 5 centuries ago. For example, at that time, the prevailing theory to explain crop failures, weather anomalies, diseases, and various other maladies and misfortunes was witchcraft, and the solution was to strap women to pyres and torch them to death. Today, no one in his right mind believes this. With the advent of a scientific understanding of agriculture, climate, disease, and other causal factors, including the role of chance, the witch theory of causality fell into disuse. So it has been and will continue to be with other forms of the hardwired equals permanent idea, such as violence. We may be hardwired for violence, but we can attenuate it considerably through scientifically tested methods. Thus, for my test case here, I predict that in another 500 years, the God theory of causality will have fallen into disuse, and the 21st century scientific theory that God is hardwired into our brains as a permanent feature of our species will be retired. The Atheism Prerequisite. Douglas Rushkoff, media analyst, documentary writer, author, Present Shock. We don't need to credit an all-seeing God with the creation of life and matter to suspect that something wonderfully strange is going on in the dimension we call reality. Most of us living in it feel invested with a sense of purpose. Whether this directionality is a genuine pre-existing condition of the universe, an illusion perpetrated by DNA, or something that will one day emerge from social interaction, has yet to be determined. At the very least, this means our experience and expectations of life can no longer be dismissed as impediments to proper observation and analysis. But science's unearned commitment to materialism has led us into convoluted assumptions about the origins of space-time, in which time itself simply must be accepted as a byproduct of the Big Bang, and consciousness, if it even exists, as a byproduct of matter. Such narratives follow information on its continuing evolution toward complexity, the singularity, and robot consciousness, a saga no less apocalyptic than the most literal interpretations of biblical prophecy. It's entirely more rational and less steeped in storybook logic to work with the possibility that time predates matter, and that consciousness is less the consequence of a physical cause-and-effect reality than a precursor. By starting with godlessness as a foundational principle of scientific reasoning, we make ourselves unnecessarily resistant to the novelty of human consciousness, its potential continuity over time, and the possibility that it has purpose. Evolution is True. Roger Highfield, Director, External Affairs, Science Museum Group, co-author with Martin Nowak, Super Cooperators. Politicians, poets, philosophers, and the religious often like to talk about the truth. In contrast, most scientists would think it overblown to describe a field of research as being true, though they do all seek the truth of mathematics. For example, quantum theory is true in the sense that experiment after experiment supports its predictions about how the world works, no matter how odd, unsettling, or counterintuitive it is. Similarly, when I studied chemistry at university, I was never told about the truth of the periodic table, though I did marvel at how Mendeleev had glimpsed the electronic structure of atoms. But why do some biologists talk about the truth so much when it comes to evolution? After all, one can hardly say that everything written about evolution is true. It's a mistake to counter irrational beliefs with rhetoric about the truth. Intelligent design and other creationist critiques have been easily shrugged off, and the facts of evolution well established in the laboratory, fossil record, DNA record, and computer simulations. If evolutionary biologists are really seekers of the truth, they need to focus more on finding the mathematical regularities of biology, following in the giant footsteps of Sewell Wright, J.B.S. Haldane, Ronald Fisher, and so on. The messiness of biology has made it relatively hard to discern the mathematical fundamentals of evolution. Perhaps the laws of biology are deductive consequences of the laws of physics and chemistry. Perhaps natural selection is not a statistical consequence of physics, but a new and fundamental physical law. Whatever the case, those universal truths, laws, that physicists and chemists all rely upon appear relatively absent from biology. Little seems to have changed from a decade ago, when the late and great John Maynard Smith wrote a chapter on evolutionary game theory for a book on the most powerful equations of science. His contribution included not a single equation. Yet there are already many mathematical formulations of biological processes, and evolutionary biology will truly have arrived the day that high school students learn the equations of life in addition to Newton's laws of motion. Moreover, if physics is an example of what a mature scientific discipline should look like, one that doesn't waste time and energy combating the agenda of science-rejecting creationists, we also need to abandon the blind adherence to the idea that the mechanics of evolution are truths that lie beyond discussion. Gravity, like evolution, exists, but Newton's view of gravitation was absorbed into another view that Einstein devised a century ago. Even today, however, there's debate about whether our understanding of gravity will have to be modified again when we're finally enlightened about the nature of the dark universe. There is no reality in the quantum world. Anton Zeilinger, physicist, University of Vienna and Institute for Quantum Optics and Quantum Information, President, Austrian Academy of Sciences, author, Dance of the Photons. What ought to be abandoned is the idea that there's no reality in the quantum world. This idea probably arose for two reasons. One, because we cannot always ascribe a precise value to a physical property, and two, because within the wide spectrum of interpretations of quantum mechanics, some suggest that the quantum state does not describe an external reality, but rather that the properties come about only in the mind of the observer, and therefore that consciousness plays a crucial role. Let's consider the famous double slit experiment. Such experiments, or their equivalents, have been performed not just with single photons, or any other kind of particles, like neutrons, protons, or electrons, but even with a beam of very large particles, such as the spherical C60 or the C70 carbon molecules, known as buckyballs. Under the right experimental conditions, you observe a distribution of the two buckyballs on the screen behind the two slits, a distribution that has maxima and minima, the interference pattern due to the interference of the probability waves passing through both slits. But, following Einstein in his famous debate with Niels Bohr, we might ask, through which slit does a particular buckyball molecule pass? Isn't it natural to assume that each molecule has to pass through either one slit or the other? Quantum physics tells us that this isn't a meaningful question. We cannot assign a well-defined position to the particle unless we perform an experiment allowing us to find out where it is. Before we do this, the position of the buckyball, and therefore which slit it passes through, is a concept devoid of meaning. Suppose we now measure the position of a particular particle in the buckyball beam. Then we get an answer. We know where it is. It's either near one slit or near the other slit. In that case, position is an element of reality, and we can say that quantum physics describes this reality. What's interesting is that if we have precise knowledge of one feature, namely the particle's position, another kind of knowledge, namely the one encoded in the interference pattern, is no longer well defined. Where would consciousness come in here? Quantum mechanics tells us that the particle, before any observation is made of it, is in a superposition of passing through both slits. If we now place two detectors, one behind each slit, then either one detector or the other will register the particle. But quantum mechanics tells us that the measurement apparatus becomes entangled with the position of the particle and thus itself lacks well-defined classical features, at least in principle. This entanglement persists until an observer registers the result. So, if we adopt that reasoning, it's the consciousness of the observer which makes reality happen. But we needn't go that far. It's enough to assume that quantum mechanics just describes the probabilities of possible measurement results. Then, making an observation turns potentiality into actuality, and in our case, the position of the buckyball becomes a quantity that one can talk reasonably about. But whether it has a well-defined position or not, the buckyball exists. It is real in the double-slit experiment, even though we cannot assign to its position a well-defined value. Space-time. Stephen Giddings, theoretical physicist, University of California, Santa Barbara. Physics has always been regarded as playing out on an underlying stage of space and time. Special relativity joined these into space-time, and general relativity taught us that this space-time itself bends and ripples, but it has remained part of the foundations of physics. However, the need to give a quantum mechanical description of reality challenges the very notion that space and time are fundamental. We specifically face the problem of reconciling the principles of quantum mechanics with the physics of gravity. At first, physicists believed this meant that space-time could violently fluctuate to the point of losing meaning, though only at extremely short distances. But attempts to reconcile quantum principles with gravitational phenomena indicate a more profound challenge to the foundational role of space-time. This comes to the fore when we study both black holes and the evolution of the universe. Space-time structure is also seemingly problematic at very long distances. Quantum mechanics appears to be an inevitable aspect of physics and is remarkably resistant to modification. If quantum principles govern nature, it seems likely that space-time arises from more fundamentally quantum structures, and its emergence is perhaps roughly analogous to the emergence of fluid behavior from the interactions of atoms. The problem with fundamental space-time is even more strongly hinted at from many developing perspectives. Notable among these hints is the physics of black holes, where it appears that evolution that respects quantum principles must violate the classical space-time dictum that information doesn't propagate faster than the speed of light. Something seems very wrong with the standard space-time picture. Evidence mounts when we consider the large-scale structure of the universe, given quantum principles and the presence of dark energy. Here, ultimately, space-time undergoes strong quantum fluctuations at very long scales and seems to lose meaning. More hints have come from candidate mathematical approaches to fluctuating space-time. The apparent need to retire classical space-time as a fundamental concept is profound, and a clear successor is not yet in sight. Various approaches to the underlying quantum framework exist. Some show promise, but none yet clearly resolves our decades-old conundrums in black holes and cosmology. The emergence of such a successor will likely be a key element in the next major revolution in physics.
The Universe. Amanda Gefter, science writer, consultant, New Scientist, author, Trespassing on Einstein's Lawn. Physics has a time-honored tradition of laughing in the face of our most basic intuitions. Einstein's relativity forced us to retire our notions of absolute space and time, while quantum mechanics forced us to retire our notions of pretty much everything else. Still, one stubborn idea has stood steadfast through it all: the universe. Sure, our picture of the universe has evolved over the years, its history dynamic, its origin inflating, its expansion accelerating. It has even been downgraded to just one in a multiverse of infinite universes forever divided by event horizons. But still, we've clung to the belief that here, as residents in the Milky Way, we all live in a single space-time, our shared corner of the cosmos, our universe. In recent years, however, the concept of a single shared space-time has sent physics spiraling into paradox. The first sign that something was amiss came from Stephen Hawking's landmark work in the 1970s, showing that black holes radiate and evaporate, disappearing from the universe and purportedly taking some quantum information with them. Quantum mechanics, however, is predicated on the principle that information can never be lost. Here was the conundrum. Once information falls into a black hole, it can't climb back out without traveling faster than light and violating relativity. Therefore, the only way to save it is to show that it never fell into the black hole in the first place. From the point of view of an accelerated observer who remains outside the black hole, that's not hard to do. Thanks to relativistic effects from his vantage point, the information stretches and slows as it approaches the black hole, then burns to scrambled ash in the heat of the Hawking radiation before it ever crosses the horizon. It's a different story, however, for the inertial, infalling observer, who plunges into the black hole, passing through the horizon without noticing any weird relativistic effects or Hawking radiation, courtesy of Einstein's equivalence principle. For him, information better fall into the black hole, or relativity is in trouble. In other words, in order to uphold all the laws of physics, one copy of the bit of information has to remain outside the black hole while its clone falls inside. Oh, and one last thing. Quantum mechanics forbids cloning. Stanford physicist Leonard Susskind eventually solved the information paradox by insisting that we restrict our description of the world to either the region of space-time outside the black hole's horizon or to the interior of the black hole. Either one is consistent. It's only when you talk about both that you violate the laws of physics. This horizon complementarity, as it became known, tells us that the inside and outside of the black hole are not part and parcel of a single universe. They are two universes, but not in the same breath. Horizon complementarity kept paradox at bay until last year, when the physics community was shaken by a new conundrum more harrowing still, the so-called firewall paradox. Here, our two observers find themselves with contradictory quantum descriptions of a single bit of information. But now the contradiction occurs while both observers are still outside the horizon, before the inertial observer falls in. That is, it occurs while they're still supposedly in the same universe. Physicists are beginning to think that the best solution to the firewall paradox may be to adopt strong complementarity. That is, to restrict our descriptions not merely to space-time regions separated by horizons, but to the reference frames of individual observers, wherever they are, as if each observer had his or her own universe. Ordinary horizon complementarity has already undermined the possibility of a multiverse. If you violate physics by describing two regions separated by a horizon, imagine what happens when you describe infinite regions separated by infinite horizons. Now, strong complementarity is undermining the possibility of a single shared universe. On a glance, you'd think it would create its own kind of multiverse, but it doesn't. Yes, there are multiple observers, and yes, any observer's universe is as good as any other's. But if you want to stay on the right side of the laws of physics, you can talk about only one at a time, which means, really, that only one exists at a time. It's cosmic solipsism. Sending the universe into early retirement is a radical move, so it better buy us something pretty in the way of scientific advancement. I think it does. For one, it might shed some light on the disconcerting low quadrupole coincidence, the fact that the cosmic microwave background radiation shows no temperature fluctuations at scales larger than 60 degrees on the sky, capping the size of space at precisely the size of our observable universe, as if reality abruptly stopped at the edge of an observer's reference frame. More important, it could offer us a better conceptual grasp of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics defies understanding because it allows things to hover in superpositions of mutually exclusive states, as when a photon goes through this slit and that slit, or when a cat is simultaneously dead and alive. It balks at our Boolean logic. It laughs at the law of the excluded middle. Worse, when we actually observe something, the superposition vanishes and a single reality miraculously unfurls. In light of the universe's retirement, this all looks slightly less miraculous. After all, superpositions are really superpositions of reference frames. In any single reference frame, an animal's vitals are well defined. Cats are only alive and dead when you try to piece together multiple frames under the false assumption that they're all part of the same universe. Finally, the universe's retirement might offer some guidance as physicists push forward with the program of quantum gravity. For instance, if each observer has his or her own universe, then each observer has his or her own Hilbert space, his or her own cosmic horizon, and his or her own version of holography. In which case, what we need from a theory of quantum gravity is a set of consistency conditions that can relate what different observers can operationally measure. Adjusting our intuitions and adapting to the strange truths uncovered by physics is never easy. But we may just have come around to the notion that there's my universe and there's your universe, but there's no such thing as the universe.
The Higgs particle closes a chapter in particle physics. Haim Harari, physicist, chair, Davidson Institute of Science Education, former president, Weizmann Institute of Science, author, A View from the Eye of the Storm. The discovery of the Higgs particle, a.k.a. the God particle, a.k.a. the goddamn particle, according to Leon Lederman, allegedly closes the chapter of establishing the standard model of particle physics, or at least so we read in the newspapers and in the announcements from Stockholm. The introduction of this idea, 5 decades ago, was indeed an important landmark in the development of the standard model. But in reality, it doesn't answer any of the remaining open questions which have plagued the model for more than 30 years. Nature has taught us that everything, not really, what about the dark matter and dark energy, is made of 6 types of quarks, why 6, and 6 types of leptons, why 6 and why the same number? They're arranged in a clear pattern which replicates itself, why, 3 times, why 3, in a precise manner. These dozen types of particles have positive or negative electric charges of exactly 0, 1, 2, or 3 units in multiples of 1/3 of the electron charge. Why always only those charges, no others? And why are quark charges even related to lepton charges? The particle masses can be described only by approximately 20 free parameters, unrelated to one another, appearing to be taken from the results of some bizarre cosmic lottery ranging over almost 10 orders of magnitude. Yes, the Higgs concept gives us a tantalizing mechanism by which these particles obtain a mass and are not massless. But this is what creates the problem. Why these masses? Who selected these numbers and why? Can it be that all of physics, and indeed all of science, is based on creating all the matter in the universe from a dozen objects with totally random mass values, while no one has the faintest idea about their origin? These mysterious mass values allegedly reflect the strength in which the Higgs particle couples to the quarks and leptons. But that's like saying that the weights of a dozen people reflect the fact that when they step on the scale, these numbers appear there. Not a very satisfying explanation. The true puzzle of the standard model is, as always in physics, what next? Something must lie beyond it, solving the puzzle of the dark matter, dark energy, particle masses, and their simple, distinct, and repetitive systematic pattern. The Higgs particle contributes absolutely nothing to the solution of these puzzles, unless the final answer is that the Higgs particle is indeed God's particle, and it is God's will that the particle masses are these and no others. Or perhaps it is not one God, but a dozen gods with diverse numerical tastes. The good news is that we still have some exciting discoveries ahead of us, deciphering the basic structure of all of matter beyond the temporary picture offered by the standard model. We certainly do not yet have a theory of everything. Not even close.
Aesthetic Motivation. Sarah Demers, Assistant Professor of Physics, Yale University. The standard model of particle physics has aesthetic shortcomings that leave us with questions. Why so many free parameters? Why not an elegant single fundamental force to account for all forces? Why three generations of quarks and leptons? Now that we have a mechanism for how fundamental particles acquire mass, why do they have those particular couplings to the Higgs field, covering such a huge range of masses? Why the even more extreme range of strengths of the fundamental forces? The potential danger with each of these questions is the answer, that's just the way it is. Besides these aesthetic concerns, we have contradictions between prediction and observation in the explored universe. We have not found a source of energy to fuel the accelerating expansion. There's insufficient baryonic matter to explain astronomical observations. We live in a large pocket of it that should not have survived annihilation. In fact, we see matter dominance everywhere we look, and no sufficient source of matter versus antimatter asymmetry to account for this. We may never access solutions to this set of problems, but accounting for each of them clearly requires at least a tweak and at best a fundamental rewriting of existing models. Their issues go beyond inelegance. Experimentalists, myself included, have been chasing aesthetically motivated or partially aesthetically motivated theories through the data. After a few years of running the Large Hadron Collider at the energy frontier and a host of careful measurements in particle, nuclear, and atomic physics carried out all over the globe, large regions of new physics parameter space have been excluded. Theorists have answered with pivots and extensions, adapting their proposed models in ways that push us to adopt more challenging experimental conditions. This exchange has seemed healthy and has definitely been fun. The close interactions have allowed for fast progress in testing new ideas. Even though the searches for non-standard model physics have resulted in new limits rather than discovery, it has been thrilling to make measurements that might provide evidence toward a grand unified theory. However, our current era of scarce resources requires tighter thinking. It's time to more carefully scrutinize our theoretical foundations. Including aesthetic considerations in the scientific toolbox has resulted in huge leaps forward. The drive for elegance has repeatedly enabled scientists to uncover underlying structure. The permission to consider aesthetics is part of what drew many of us to become scientists in the first place. I'm not arguing that we ought to abandon it forever. But we're currently in a data-rich period in particle physics, after years of being, at least at the energy frontier, data poor. Ensuring that data get the final say is more essential than anything else in the practice of science. And the data we have in hand could say a lot about the standard model. There's even more on the line when we consider which experiments to pursue next. At this stage, with 96% of the universe's content in the dark, It's a mistake to put aesthetic concerns on a par with contradictions when it comes to theoretical motivation. With no explanation for dark energy, no confirmed detection of dark matter, and no sufficient mechanism for matter-antimatter asymmetry, we have too many gaps to worry about elegance. Theorists will keep pushing for grand unified theories, including developing the mathematics to enable further progress. Experimentalists have an opportunity and a responsibility to provide direction through agnostic hunts for discrepancies between our data and the standard model predictions. This includes, of course, measuring the hell out of the newly discovered Higgs boson. It's time for us to admit that some of the models we've been chasing from our brilliant theory colleagues might actually be gorgeous Hail Mary passes to the universe. Our next significant level of understanding will likely come because we're forced there by painstakingly determined constraints from the data rather than by a lucky catch. Naturalness, hierarchy, and space-time. Maria Spyropoulou, Professor of Physics, Caltech. Naturalness, hierarchy, and space-time, as invoked today in physics, will be retired sooner than later. The naturalness strategy and hierarchy problem for building models towards theories that extend the standard model of particles and their interactions, call it STH, standard theory a la David Gross, are crumbling with the measurements of the newly discovered Higgs-like boson. I'll call it Higgs-like until we've measured it exhaustively at the Large Hadron Collider. Nonetheless, we've built ourselves a story for what comes after the Higgs elementary scalar, a story that the real world doesn't seem to abide by. So, our enslavement by the need to be natural, not finely tuned, subjective notions we should have objected to much earlier, is being lifted as we speak, and the road to high energy may be surprisingly more complex than what we were envisioning. Toward the end of the road, and there may be none such if the road curves back at us, there is gravity and space-time entering the mix of physics notions that are hairy and loopy, and we'll have to upgrade them, too, if not retire them altogether. On related physics ideas, the notions about the particle nature of dark matter might also crumble. Some big revolutions and discoveries are in store regarding fundamental notions about our quantum universe.
Scientists ought to know everything scientifically knowable. Ed Regis, science writer, co-author with George Church, Regenesis. In 1993, two Nobel Prize-winning physicists, Steven Weinberg and Leon Lederman, each published books suggesting that a 54-mile-long particle accelerator, the Superconducting Supercollider, SSC, should be constructed near Waxahachie, Texas, in order to discover the elusive Higgs scalar boson, which Lederman had semi-facetiously dubbed the God Particle. The books were Dreams of a Final Theory and The God Particle, respectively. In a tour de force of bad timing, both books came out just as the U.S. Congress was in the process of terminating funding for the project once and for all. Which was just as well. As it happened, the Higgs boson was discovered in 2012 by scientists working at a much smaller accelerator, the 17-mile-long Large Hadron Collider, LHC, at CERN, near Geneva. As often happens in science, a new discovery simultaneously raises several new questions, which, of course, was also the case with the Higgs. For instance, why did the Higgs particle have precisely the mass it had? Were there yet even more basic particles that lay beneath and explained certain attributes of the Higgs? Was there, in fact, more than one Higgs boson? In fundamental particle theory, unfortunately, the answers to such questions have become increasingly, and even prohibitively, expensive. Before it was cancelled, cost estimates for the SSC rose from an initial $3.9 billion to a final $11 billion-plus in 1991. But how much is it really worth to know the answers to further questions regarding the Higgs particle? How much, if anything, would you pay to know those answers, assuming, optimistically, that you could even understand such questions as, how does the Higgs boson explain, if at all, the phenomenon of electroweak symmetry breaking? Science has long since reached the point where some types of new knowledge can be discovered only by building structures so absurdly cosmic and even comic in size as to have equally cosmic price tags. In light of this, it makes sense to ask whether the knowledge supposedly to be provided by these dollar bill-destroying behemoths is in fact worth acquiring. Apparently unfazed by congressional rejection of the super collider, a 2001 study group at Fermilab, whose accelerator was a relatively puny 4 miles around, seriously entertained the prospect of building a very large Hadron Collider, VLHC, a stupendous monster that would be fully 233 kilometers, 145 miles, in circumference. This Leviathan object would enclose an area more than 400 square miles larger than the state of Rhode Island. Then, in the summer of 2013, a year after the Higgs had been discovered, a group of particle physicists met at Minneapolis to propose a 62-mile-long collider that they said would allow the study of indirect effects of new physics on the W and Z bosons, the top quark, and other systems. These proposals just keep coming, like spam, junk mail, or crabgrass. But sooner or later, enough has got to be enough, even in science, which, after all, is not sacrosanct. It's just silly to keep paying, forever, eternally, and in perpetuity, more and more money for less and less knowledge about hypothetical specks of matter that go so far beyond the infinitesimal as to border on sheer nothingness. Fundamental particle physicists, evidently, have never heard of limits to growth, or limits of any other kind. But they should certainly acquaint themselves with that concept, for the fundamental does not automatically trump the practical. Every dollar spent on a shiny new mega-collider is a dollar that can't be spent on other things, such as hospitals, vaccine development, epidemic prevention, disaster relief, and so on. Particle accelerators the size of small nations are arguably well over the financial horizon of what's reasonable to sacrifice for a given incremental advance in arcane, theoretical, almost cabalistic knowledge. In a postmortem on the superconducting supercollider, goodbye to the SSC, science historian Daniel J. Kevlis wrote that basic research in physics should be pursued, but not at any price. I agree. Some scientific knowledge is simply not worth its cost. Falsifiability. Sean Carroll, theoretical physicist, Caltech, author, The Particle at the End of the Universe. In a world where scientific theories often sound bizarre and counter to everyday intuition, and a wide variety of nonsense aspires to be recognized as scientific, it's important to be able to separate science from non-science, what philosophers call the demarcation problem. Karl Popper famously suggested the criterion of falsifiability. A theory is scientific if it makes clear predictions that can be unambiguously falsified. It's a well-meaning idea, but far from the complete story. Popper was concerned with theories such as Freudian psychoanalysis and Marxist economics, which he considered non-scientific. No matter what actually happens to people or societies, Popper claimed, theories like these will always be able to tell a story in which the data are compatible with the theoretical framework. He contrasted this with Einstein's relativity, which made specific quantitative predictions ahead of time. One prediction of general relativity was that the universe should be expanding or contracting, leading Einstein to modify the theory because he thought the universe was actually static. So, even in this example, the falsifiability criterion is not as unambiguous as it seems. Modern physics, stretches into realms far removed from everyday experience, and sometimes the connection to experiment becomes tenuous at best. String theory and other approaches to quantum gravity involve phenomena that are likely to manifest themselves only at energies enormously higher than anything we have access to here on Earth. The cosmological multiverse and the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics posit other realms impossible for us to access directly. Some scientists, leaning on Popper, have suggested that these theories are non-scientific because they're not falsifiable. The truth is the opposite. Whether or not we can observe them directly, the entities involved in these theories are either real or they are not. Refusing to contemplate their possible existence on the grounds of some a priori principle, even though they might play a crucial role in how the world works, is as non-scientific as it gets. The falsifiability criterion gestures toward something true and important about science, but it's a blunt instrument in a situation calling for subtlety and precision. It's better to emphasize two central features of good scientific theories. They are definite, and they're empirical. By definite, we mean that they say something clear and unambiguous about how reality functions. String theory says that in certain regions of parameter space, ordinary particles behave as loops or segments of one-dimensional strings. The relevant parameter space might be inaccessible to us, but it's part of the theory which cannot be avoided. In the cosmological multiverse, regions unlike our own are unambiguously there, even if we can't reach them. This is what distinguishes these theories from the approaches Popper was trying to classify as non-scientific. Popper himself understood that theories should be falsifiable in principle, but that modifier is often forgotten in contemporary discussions. It's the empirical criterion that requires some care. On the face of it, this criterion might be mistaken for makes falsifiable predictions. But in the real world, the interplay between theory and experiment isn't so cut and dried. A scientific theory is ultimately judged by its ability to account for the data, but the steps along the way to that accounting can be indirect. Consider the multiverse, often invoked as a potential solution to some of the fine-tuning problems of contemporary cosmology. For example, we believe there's a small but non-zero vacuum energy inherent in empty space. This is the leading theory to explain the observed acceleration of the universe, for which the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded. The problem for theorists is not that vacuum energy is hard to explain. It's that the predicted value is enormously larger than what we observe. If the universe we see around us is the only one there is, the vacuum energy is a unique constant of nature, and we're faced with the problem of explaining it. If, on the other hand, we live in a multiverse, the vacuum energy could be completely different in different regions, and an explanation suggests itself immediately. In regions where the vacuum energy is much larger, conditions are inhospitable to the existence of life. There is therefore a selection effect, and we should predict a small value of the vacuum energy. Indeed, using this precise reasoning, Steven Weinberg did predict the value of the vacuum energy long before the acceleration of the universe was discovered. We can't, as far as we know, observe other parts of the multiverse directly, but their existence has a dramatic effect on how we account for the data in the part of the multiverse we do observe. It's in that sense that the success or failure of an idea is ultimately empirical. Its virtue is not that it's a neat idea or fulfills some nebulous principle of reasoning, but that it helps us account for the data, even if we'll never visit those other universes. Science isn't merely armchair theorizing. It's about explaining the world we see, developing models that fit the data. But fitting models to data is a complex and multifaceted process involving a give and take between theory and experiment, as well as the gradual development of theoretical understanding in its own right. In complicated situations, fortune cookie-sized mottos like theories should be falsifiable are no substitute for careful thinking about how science works. Fortunately, science marches on, largely heedless of amateur philosophizing. If string theory and multiverse theories help us understand the world, they'll grow in acceptance. If they prove ultimately too nebulous or better theories come along, they'll be discarded. The process might be messy, but nature is the ultimate guide.